is 53. The record high for the state is 85. That mark set in 2003. The sun will set this evening at 7:34. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The morning show with Greg Berg is coming up.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, delighted to be welcoming back into our studios, as we do once a month, Nan Calvert from the Seno Conservancy for her monthly visit, in which we tackle an important environmental issue of one kind or another. And today, we're going to be talking about the soil from which so many things spring and which keep the human race fed and keep our environment healthy. And we're going to be talking very specifically about the soil that is developed, created at Blue Ribbon Organics Farms, which is located in Caledonia, not far from the 7 Mile Fair.
Yep, about if you've quarter mile south of 7 Mile Fair.
Right. So if you've seen that iconic building on the beside the interstate as you're heading up to Milwaukee, then you know pretty much the stomping grounds of James Utrunka, who is the owner of the farm of Blue Ribbon Organics. And so we're going to be talking with him about the importance of good, rich, wonderful soil and how composting can be a absolutely essential component in creating the very best possible soil. So, Nan Calvert, James Utrunka, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Well, thanks. So happy to be here again.
So, Nan, explain how you came across James the first time. How did you come to know about James and Blue Ribbon Organics?
I happened to be driving along, and I turned on the radio, and I caught the last few seconds, really, of an interview that Susan Bentz was doing with James. And I was fascinated by what they were talking about, so I Googled him and found out that, oh, my goodness, he's right in Caledonia. And so I thought, boy, people need to know about this. People need to know about what James is doing and why it's so important and how they can contribute and all of those kinds of things, and just to spread the good word about good soil.
And to clarify that it's soil, yes, and not dirt.
Yes, James and I were talking about that earlier. We don't say dirt. We say soil.
Dirt has no life. Soil is full of life.
That's right.
Ah, and there's the difference.
There is a difference.
Well, before we start talking about soil and Blue Ribbon Organics, James, let's just find out a little bit more about who you are and specifically where you come from, although I understand that where you come from is where you are currently.
Yep.
So I haven't moved too far. Tell us.
Our DNR-regulated compost facility is located on our family farm, where I'm actually the sixth generation using the land. Before that, we were dairy farmers, vegetable farmers. How we actually started was we were a landscape business. And we were taking our yard waste, with landscape and a nursery, and we were using our yard waste to create our own compost for our nursery stock, versus buying it, because we were having trouble finding a quality product to be a good growing medium for the nursery stock. As we started creating the soil, we realized the good results we were getting based off how the nursery stock was doing, that we actually decided to open up a DNR site and accept yard waste from other landscapers, municipalities, homeowners. So leaves, grass, brush, and then it also opened the door to food waste. So food waste from grocery stores. So whatever's in a produce section has a shelf life. When that shelf life is met, it goes into an organics bin, and it's actually hauled to our farm. And we compost roughly around 75 tons of food waste a week.
Wow.
So all of our product that is produced at our facility is mixed with food waste.
Wow. We'll get into those details in just a second. So when you grew up on this farm, you were not in the compost business.
No.
Tell us the farm as you remember it as a young person growing up.
Oh, the farm as I remember it. It's changed so much. When I was first moved there, they were just starting to get out of the vegetable farming part. So I really don't remember that as much. My primary memory is more the landscaping part that my dad started. He started that in like 1988, and then he worked at Snap-on in Kenosha here full-time, and then did the landscape part part-time. And then in 99, he stopped working at Snap-on and went into landscaping full-time. So when I went to college in 2005, I thought that's what I was going to do. I thought I was going to take over the landscaping business. When really my junior year of college, we started the compost facility.
Wow.
And now that's primarily all we do.
When you went to college, first of all, where did you go and what did you study? I mean, were you studying something that was going to relate to what you presumed to be your career path?
Sort of. I went to UWM, and I actually went for a marketing degree, because I thought it would help. The business degree would help with marketing than the landscape company. So in a sense, I kind of wish I would have went to something more agricultural or soil-based, but the marketing degree has been tremendous as far as launching this part of our business.
By the way, as you were, for instance, in high school, did you ever entertain very seriously the possibility of not carrying on in your father's business? I mean, or being connected with the farm? I mean, moving far away and doing something completely different, or did that idea scarcely never dawn on you?
Kind of always. I'm not sure what grade it was. Fourth grade, I wrote a dare essay where I was going to take over the landscape business. So, I mean, I guess it was pretty early on that I knew I was going to do something relating to the farm or what we were doing at that time.
Very good. So let's get back to what you started to talk about, which is namely that this move towards getting into the compost business had at least something to do with the difficulty that apparently you and your father had in securing the best kind of soil that you needed for your landscape business. First of all, what are we talking about that you were wanting to grow for which you needed especially high quality soil?
Oh, what we were doing is instead of planting in the ground, we were planting in little gallon jugs. And mostly we were doing just evergreen trees. But what we wanted was more of a higher nitrogen product versus a lot of the composts on the market are more of a carbon source product. So carbon source is what I mean is brush grinding and leaves. Nitrogen sources are where we derive our nitrogen source from is food waste or food residuals. Residuals is also the, like dirt. It's not waste, it's residuals is what the DNR is really trying to promote because it's not really a product that should be considered in the waste stream because it has a reusable source, like way to use it.
I see. And when something is waste, it's, in a sense, useless.
Useless,
or for the most part, useless.
Correct.
So, and this is not useless at all, of course.
Oh.
So you were needing this higher quality soil, and you were just finding it really difficult to find?
Difficult, not as much as difficult to find as expensive for the results we were getting. So we were trying to find, well, one, we were having the waste from our yard waste as it was, so it was putting that waste then, now it's had benefit, to use and use it into kind of a more of like a full circle part of the nursery, you know, the yard waste from the landscape side being reused to the nursery side.
Right. So in other words, you already had on hand at least part of what was involved.
Yep.
Or what would be necessary to create a large amount of compost, and you figured maybe we should just fill in the other gaps in the process and just do this ourselves.
Yep. And then other landscapers wondering where our yard waste was going, knowing that we were doing it at the farm, that's when they started inquiring, hey, can we bring our waste to you as well? And that's when we decided to go for the DNR permit to bring in, you know, I think there's 10 to 12 landscape companies that come to us, about 12 municipalities. So it kind of opened the door to letting them in legally and being regulated by the DNR.
Yeah, you've talked about the DNR several times already in the course of the interview and how your Blue Ribbon Organics is some kind of official DNR site. So maybe we should talk about the point at which the DNR, the Department of Natural Resources, gets involved in all this. For instance, you just mentioned getting a permit from the DNR. A permit to do what?
A permit to accept. I have two permits to accept yard waste. So we have a 20,000 or less cubic yard permit for yard waste, and then we have a 5,000 or less cubic yard, and that's in process for food waste or food residuals. And the reason that the DNR plays such a role in that is, one, regulating where the material is going because it is banned from the landfill, to water, like water runoff, water control runoff, and mostly just making sure that it's properly being handled, properly being composted and being sent off to wherever it's going in a safe fashion.
So if we're talking about a certain amount of this material, you need to have a permit.
Yes.
So Nan in her backyard just couldn't just take it upon herself to...
50 yards or less is under a permit.
Okay,
in
so
process at time,
that, that much you can do on your own, but when you get above that, then...
Yep.
So what do you remember about that process of deciding to do this on your own? Did it seem like a kind of a big leap of faith? I mean, was it a risk you were taking? Were you... And what about the process of, you know, I suppose, shuttering the old business that was in place?
It actually wasn't too bad. I reached out to UW Extension to Joe Van Rossum, who was kind of in charge of getting the education of how to set up a facility like one that we have currently, and he was great. I went to one workshop with him, and he came out to the farm and took a look at our land, make sure it met the specs, and kind of guided me into getting going for the DNR permit. And then I actually did the DNR permit in Sturtevant at the time. He came out, looked at it, and it was actually a very pretty simple process because our infrastructure was set up for the compost site. We had compacted clay, we had water runoff, and we had the area. That's the biggest part, is you need to have at least between seven and 10 acres to run the compost site on.
Hmm. Now, I think at least, I'm sure quite a few of our listeners understand at least on some level what composting is when you're literally doing it in your backyard. I mean, and you know, relatively small operation. It appears to be just a fairly simple matter of just letting certain stuff pile up until it turns into compost. When we're talking about an operation as extensive as yours, Is it still, in a sense, as simple as that?
No. It's a lot of work. We do all of our turning technique. So everything's in windrow. So it goes through a mixing station.
Wait, what was the first thing?
Windrow technique.
Windrow?
Windrow, okay. Yeah. It's windrow style composting.
Okay.
So they have static where you put it on a pile and you leave it. And that just takes longer and it's not quite the quality as a product. Or we do all ours windrow style techniques. So it's brought in, it's mixed, the yard and the food waste are mixed together, and then it goes into the windrow. And then it's monitored by temperature and moisture. And so once the material is in these windrows, we have a windrow turner that pretty much straddles the row. The rows are about 10 feet wide by 6 feet tall, and then they stretch from, they're all various sizes depending on where we have them on our site. And so they're monitored by temperature and moisture, and then they're turned weekly to twice a week depending on what the weather is. And usually from start to finish, it takes about 4 months from start to finish for the product to be ready.
What's the percentage between the food residual and the yard waste?
The carbon and nitrogen is 3-1. Carbon source, again, is the brush and the leaves. Mm-hmm. And then the food waste is the nitrogen. So it's about 3-1.
Mm-hmm. And that ends up creating this soil that's of a higher quality, at least as far as you're concerned.
Yep.
And is it that kind of soil that is more nitrogen-based rather than carbon-based is better for what you guys were doing, or in general, is that for just about everything a higher quality compost?
Just about everything, mostly vegetable gardening. That's kind of what we moved into now, is we work with a lot of community gardens, a lot of homeowners that just grow in their backyard. We wholesale quite a bit of it as well, but our main gear has been pushing the product out in community gardens. So Victory Garden Initiative, they do a blitz every May, where they build 500 garden beds in 2 weeks. It's actually May 7th through the 21st, I think, this year. And we work with Growing Power, where we were making their product, and they use it internally for all their hoop houses throughout the city, growing various types of vegetables for their processing. Groundwork Milwaukee, Compost Kids. So it's just a lot of entities that also are kind of pushing the awareness of why compost is important, using as a growing medium for your backyard. And not only that, but having a quality soil to get the best results for your plants, get the most yield out of your small little garden box. And then it's a safe product. You know, all of our product is tested quarterly. It's certified organic. It runs through the U.S. Composting Council to be certified for flowers and vegetables, trees and shrubs, and lawn application. But that's mostly just to show, you know, when you are dealing with food, you got to be careful, because for other diseases, salmonella, any fecal matter. So it's always tested for maturity. Mm. So,
for those of you just joining us, we have Nan Calvert in the studio, and she has brought with her our special guest today, James Utrunka, who is the owner and operator of Blue Ribbon Organics, located in Caledonia. And they are in the soil business and the compost business. And so they... create? Is that is that too audacious a word to use? You create an exceptionally high quality of compost. Let's talk a little bit about the process by which the building blocks come to you. You've touched on this already, but I think you said by a ratio of 3-1 yard waste and then food waste or residuals, that's what we're talking about. Let's talk about the yard waste. Is that what we called it?
Mm-hmm.
So exactly where does that come from, and how does it get to you? And when it gets to you, what do you do with it?
Okay. Like I said, it comes from local municipalities, landscapers. Some homeowners come. Like I said, I think it's like 12 to 14 municipalities bring their waste to us, and at least 12 landscapers. So what mostly comes in is the brush will come in, is entire. So if you cut a tree down in the tree branch, tree trunks, that comes in, and it goes into, we grind it all. It goes through a horizontal grinder. So it looks like a giant chipper, but it's pretty large. And
is there a rule on what can be brought to you? I mean, before it gets to you, does it need to be of a certain size, or are you able and willing to handle just about anything that people are willing to transport to you?
It's certain sizes. For length, it's around 10 to 12 feet in length. As far as diameter, we try to stay around like a 16, 18 inch chunk. And that's mostly just, like you said, size of our grinder and what it can handle.
Right. So, for instance, I was just at Petrifying Springs the other day and for the first time saw kind of the carnage there of the hundreds and hundreds of ash trees that came down. So, presumably, could some of those have been brought to you?
Yeah.
Were they? Would they have already been ground up to some extent at Petrifying Springs before they ever even got to Blue Ribbon?
Sure. What happened there was the emerald ash borer. So we're able to accept that material because of how high the temperatures are inside our windrows when we're composting. They get up to 150, 160 degrees, and it maintains that temperature for almost a month, and then it's regulated even more for where we eliminate the unwanted pathogens, like I said, salmonella, free of weed seed. That's kind of another big point of compost maturity is not that you won't get weeds in your garden, but our compost will not generate its own weeds on its own, whereas a lot of unfinished compost will still have the weed seed that from whatever was brought in, and it'll germinate.
So that's part of the process too.
That's part of the process.
To expunge all of that. So you have this coming in from all kinds of different places, municipalities, even some private homeowners or whatever will just bring this to you. Are you buying it from them, or are they paying you to take it, or is any money exchanged at all in that transaction?
They pay what's called the tipping fee. So the tipping fee comes in, and that pretty much helps us cover the cost of grinding the material, so getting it into a state where it's usable for us in our processes.
Right. So somebody just shows up with their flatbed truck, and is it weighed?
We do it by the yard. We have another facility that we started working with January 1st. It's actually over by Advance, the landfill. It's their composting side, so what they don't put into the landfill goes to a compost facility over there. That's weighed by the ton. So we kind of, both sides do it differently.
Okay. So that comes to you. The other portion, and in some ways it's quite critical because it makes a difference in creating compost, creating soil that's especially high quality, is the matter of food residuals. So where does that come from?
That mostly comes from Walmarts in our area. We've been taking that for... They've been composting, I think, for almost 8 or 9, maybe more. So they have a food waste hauler that picks up from every grocery store, every Walmart in the state of Wisconsin. And they started that they didn't want it to go to a landfill. They wanted to go either to a compost facility or some sort of renewable energy, so anaerobic digestion. So they've been doing that for, like I said, it's got to be about 9, 10 years.
Wow. So that's where most of your food residual
comes
from.
That's a large bulk. And then now we have other entities like Outpost Natural Foods. I know Whole Foods necessarily doesn't come to us, but they send it to a compost facility. A lot of restaurants are on board in Milwaukee. A worker with Compost Crusader and Santa Max are the two haulers that bring into our facility and work with other restaurants, a lot of corporate buildings that want to their corporate cafeterias or their coffee grant, you know, it's kind of opening up the door to a lot of different areas, not just grocery stores.
Right. So what kind of food is appropriate to be used for this? I mean, is essentially anything from the produce and, I don't know, the meat areas too or whatever, but, I mean, we're not composting leftover, you know, cans of SpaghettiOs. I understand that. But, I mean, in terms of the kind of food we're talking about, is anything okay?
We stay away from anything like uncooked meats is one thing we do kind of steer clear about. Not that we can't accept it. It's just more of a hazier area as far as, but we can take pre-consumed cooked meat. So like off your dinner plate, if you have a chicken bone or if you have a little piece of your steak that you didn't finish and it was cooked, that can go into the organics bin.
Well, then, and certain things you buy in the grocery store that you're essentially reheating. I mean, like certain breakfast sausages and so on. That you get the impression from the packaging that at some point they were cooked, and you're just recooking them or reheating them when you prepare them. Is something like that okay?
I would say it would be, but I'm not sure if that's coming to us because that's more of like a packaged good. mostly what ours is pre-consumer waste. So like what's at a grocery store shelf, an apple,
right?
That it expired on its shelf life by their regulations, it goes into organics bins. So organic apples, oranges, watermelons, pumpkins. You know, it's kind of funny if you come to the site at different times of the year, you'll see, you'll know it's fall when the pumpkins are there, or you'll see, know it's summer when the watermelons are there. So
right. What about something like cheese or eggs?
Dairy, yeah, we can accept dairy.
Okay.
Yep.
How about eggs?
Eggs, yes.
Is that dairy? I mean, okay.
Well, yeah. It's always included in
it's always
dairy,
included.
But I mean, technically, it doesn't come from a cow, obviously.
Right.
But it's always included in dairy.
In that, as a category.
So. I was just curious when you were talking about brush cuttings and woody species waste. Is there anything that you don't accept?
Oh, any type of like black walnut, we okay. stay away from.
Mm-hmm.
That's mostly just because the root structures of most plants have issues growing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like where black walnut trees are, even under the root structure,
mm-hmm.
they'll have trouble growing.
And right. that's because of a sort of a toxicity
right.
issue?
Mm-hmm. It's allelopathic, so it outcompetes primarily non-native species. So when you're talking about growing food, those are what most people are growing in their gardens are non-native species. But when you go into a mixed hardwood forest, you'll see lots of things growing around a black walnut, but they won't necessarily be non-native species. Unfortunately, it doesn't kill off buckthorn or honeysuckle, but,
too bad.
Do you take buckthorn?
No, not really.
Good.
It's not something that normally comes in our site, no.
Well, what would be the issue there?
Well, if you, what happens sometimes is that if a sizable female buckthorn is cut down and she is just festooned with berries, mm-hmm. it can end up back in the composting system, and then you're just replanting buckthorn. In a raised bed, it's not that big of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's a farmer or a homeowner who's using this compost to enhance their soils, then you're just replanting buckthorn.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, which nobody
wants.
Which
is a bad thing.
A very bad thing. So back to the food residuals. So this comes to you from Walmarts and restaurants and this and that. What are you doing with that when it first arrives? I mean, compared to what you're doing with the lawn waste, for instance.
Well, when that comes in, it's mixed right away as soon as it comes in the door with the yard waste. So with those grindings, it comes in, it's mixed, and it's placed into those windrows that I was talking about earlier.
So not much in the way of processing has to occur.
It's just I don't have to grind the material like the yard waste. But as far as once it's mixed and goes into those windrows, it's processed the same as the yard waste because it's mixed with it.
Mm-hmm. Tell us more about that process then once something has been, when that combination has been created and sort of placed. Tell us more about the process that occurs from that.
So once it goes into the windrows, like I said, the turning frequency is a little higher at the beginning of the cycle, mostly because we don't want the material to go, they call it anaerobic. When it goes anaerobic, it means the microorganisms quit working. There's millions of microorganisms. They're like our little free workers, essentially. We just
right.
want to keep them happy. We want to keep them filled with oxygen. We want to make sure they get water, but we want to make sure they don't get too much water. That's where the turning process comes in. Adding oxygen, and sometimes we have to add water to the windrows if the material is too dry, different times of the year. Sometimes we have to turn more often if the material is too wet, too compacted. So, like I said, from start to finish, it takes about 4 months, and part of that 4 months has a 20-day curing stage. And what the curing stage is once the material, we have a test that we run, and once that material we feel is mature, goes into this curing stage, and mostly that's just to check to make sure that the compost didn't reactivate, and that's mostly monitored by temperature. Mm-hmm. But it's amazing what it looks like from the beginning, thinking if it's a leaf or brush grindings or an apple, and at the end that the finished product, because it also goes through a 3/8 Trommel screen to eliminate a lot of unwanted large chunks, or if there is a piece of plastic that comes through. That's eliminated from the finished product.
Mm-hmm.
But from start to finish, when you see the two side by side, it's kind of an amazing thing to even believe that we can create that.
Yeah, that it starts out as this and it ends up as this.
Yep.
Something very, very different.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that turning process. How is it turned?
Oh, that's on the back of our windrow turner. So what it is, it's like a giant hood that straddles the row, and there's about a, I don't know how big it is in diameter, probably like a 12-foot diameter drum that has knives on it or little plates that pretty much just spin, and they rotate around, and that just pretty much takes the pile and flips it inside out, and it leaves it in a nice cone shape, and that's, again, for when it rains or catching water that it will absorb water, but if there's too much rain, it'll run off the sides of the rows. So that pretty much enhances our processing by 2 months using this windrow turner, because it's just more of a proper turn. It's aerating the pile more consistently.
Right. What does it smell like?
Smells good. I'm used to it. Right. You know, when it first comes in, we got to be very careful with odors, keeping a lot of the fruits and vegetables covered. And the finished product, it just smells very earthy.
Mm-hmm. Right. I was going to say, it's not so much the finished product I'm wondering about, but what it's like in before it's ultimately become compost.
Yeah. I get the question a lot from customers of before they come pick up the product or come look at it of what's it look like, what's it smell like, can you tell food was in it? And no, you can't. Mm-hmm. The only way that you can tell that food was in it is it's a darker black color. Hmm. Than a carbon source compost.
Right.
I mean, even the rule of thumb for home composting on a very small scale is if you can smell it, something's going wrong. Mm-hmm. I mean, you need to either turn it more often or you need to adjust your percentages of, you know, green versus brown. And so it really shouldn't have a smell. And at the end, it's just earthy. It's beautiful.
You're 100% right. I mean, that's part of the odor control is our turning frequency. Right. Like you said, when it goes anaerobic, that is when you get your odors.
A little stinky. Mm-hmm. Did I hear you correctly? Did you say 75 tons of food waste every week?
Per week.
75 tons of residual. I'm sorry, not waste, but food residual every single week. That's mind-boggling. Wow. I don't even know what that looks like.
Right. I can't conceive of it. And it's great to think about that amount of food residual getting used in a beneficial way. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just almost tragic to think about if it weren't being used that way, what's just sort of senseless waste that would represent.
And that's just from Walmart.
Well,
primarily,
and like Sanimex and Compost Crusader pick up from a lot of other entities, but that would be, I'd say, the bulk of the food waste.
Yeah.
Residuals. What happens with your windrow turning schedule in the winter?
Well, that's actually handled completely different. We don't use a windrow turner in the winter months. What we do is actually build them into larger windrows that are, I would say roughly guessing 15 feet wide by 12 feet tall. And why we do that is primarily to keep as much heat inside those windrows as possible during the cold months. And the turning frequency in the winter goes down way less than what we do in the summer, spring, summer, and fall. You know, we're turning those windrows closer to once a month. So, production-wise for us in the wintertime really slows down compared to what we're doing in the spring, summer, and fall, although it does not stop.
Mm. So you continue accepting food residual,
yep.
But it's just a much slower process.
Yep.
And how many total acres do you have on your farm?
The whole compost site is zoned off for 16 acres. Mm. It's a 32-acre farm.
And is that zoned agricultural, or is it business, or is it...
The compost site zone M3, which is actually heavy industrial.
Oh.
So it's a pretty heavy zoning for what we're doing. And I think that was mostly because we're stockpiling materials on the site, so that's how it fell under their code.
We're speaking with James Utrunka, who is the owner and operator of Blue Ribbon Organics in Caledonia, and they are in the compost business in a very big way, as we've been talking about. And Nan Calvert, of course, is with us here as well. James, several points along the way here, you've been talking about the testing that occurs. And that's one thing I find really fascinating and intriguing, the notion of, on the one hand, a lot of what you do just seems like the, pardon the pun, but, you know, very earthy kind of process. I mean, we don't think of it as being kind of a high-tech business. Mm-hmm. And yet you keep talking about what sound like, I would imagine, to be fairly sophisticated scientific testing that is going on all along the process. I mean, talk a moment about how that testing occurs and with what kind of equipment and how sophisticated is it and how smart do you have to be to even know how to do that part of this operation?
Oh, man. Well, the testing, the testing isn't something that really we do in-house. That's all sent to a certified lab.
Ah.
The lab actually has to be a certified lab through the U.S. Composting Council to be enrolled in their programs. And they have a testing method. I can't think of what it's called off my head, but a testing method where there's a ton of tests that are done on the product, but some of the main ones are carbon nitrogen, compost maturity, moisture content, organic matter, phosphorus, nitrogen, potassium, calcium. There's just a ton of tests that are ran on there, as well as trace minerals, any heavy metals to make sure they're not in there. And like I said, one of the larger tests is a salmonella test. And that's also for the certification for organic. So we're certified for organic. So there's actually two. There's the U.S. Composting Council that we have a certified through, which requires testing. And then it's called OMRI, which is Organic Materials Review Institute, which certifies it for organic production.
And so are you sending off to this testing lab then a sample from this batch of compost?
Yep, quarterly. So okay. four times a year.
And how much are you sending off then?
Oh, for the testing?
Right.
It's actually in like a little cooler, and it's, I don't know how heavy the bags are. I would say they're three large Ziploc bags.
Wow, okay.
But they have to be pulled. There's how the core sampling for like off the pile is. You have to take it from different areas of the pile, so it's not just one section.
Right.
You're trying to pull from the entire bag.
So it's truly representative.
Yeah.
So let's talk about this term organic. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, most people, even if they're as ignorant as I do, know at least something of what it means to buy an organic carrot from the grocery store. I mean, what that terminology typically represents. Although it's important to say that that's a term that sometimes gets misused. We're not as careful about that as maybe we should be. I think we're probably getting better at that. When it comes to your compost being certified as organic, what does that delineation mean? I mean, I think a lot of people would assume that all compost is organic.
Mm-hmm.
In what sets it apart when it's labeled organic?
I think it's just more of that the consumer is understanding that this is derived from all organic materials. It's processed organically. We're not adding any additives to it to enhance it, speed up the process. That everything's being done naturally, and that they understand that we're taking an extra step to have it certified that they can use it in organic production. Now, not a lot of our customers don't use it in organic production, but say if they use organic seeds, it's more of like a good feeling that they're using a quality product.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a nice marketing tool for us to show the consumers or tell the consumers, this is how we're doing it. We're doing it an all-natural way.
Right. So it is at least theoretically possible for composting to be done non-organically. I mean, it is possible to introduce what would be sort of non-organic elements into the process, and that's something you choose not to do.
Mm-hmm. Correct. I mean, there's a lot of feedstocks that we reject, you know, throughout the year that don't fall under... the OMRI certifications of what we can accept. We did a thing with SC Johnson a few years ago where we took their filter cake from their shaving cream line, and we were actually one of the first compost sites to have industrial waste compost facility. It's 1 acre on our site. Mm-hmm. And what we did with them was actually composted this filter cake from the wastewater treatment plant, mix it with yard waste, and then they bought it back and use it on their property. But I couldn't accept, even though it was considered a material that could be accepted because it didn't fall under like a waste, it's something I could not accept on a daily basis if I was going to keep this certified organic material.
Interesting.
So that's just an idea. There are several. There's a list from OMRI that we have to stay under to meet the regulations for what's considered organic feedstock.
So once the compost is created at Blue Ribbon Organics, then you are confronted with the matter of selling it.
Yep.
So tell us about that process and to whom, generally speaking, your compost is being sold?
We sell it to a lot of homeowners where they can come pick it up directly, or we deliver it to their homes, so their home gardens, their flower beds. A lot of customers use it for top dressing their lawn. So if they're having trouble with their lawn, if there was enough topsoil put in when it was a new home that the grass, the root structure is having trouble taking, what they'll do is this natural fertilizer where they'll actually top dress their lawns with this a few times to build the organic matter up on their lawn. We also sell it, like I said, through the community gardens in Milwaukee, Milwaukee, Racine, Kenosha. We also sell it a lot of wholesale, so other landscape supply companies carry our product as well, which kind of pushes our market to areas that we don't deliver in. And then, I guess that would be primarily what we're selling our finished product to.
And it just bears the name Blue Ribbon Compost?
Blue Ribbon Organic Compost. And the rebranding happened, I just launched, April 1st is when I unrolled from the farm's compost into Blue Ribbon Organics.
Oh, okay.
So where we did the name change or the rebranding.
Very good.
Now, I know you work with schools as well. Can you talk about that?
Oh, yeah. So we have some of the haulers that haul the food waste to us pick up from their cafeterias, school cafeterias. And then that's actually hauled to us. And a lot of, like now what we're trying, that we're seeing is that more schools are trying to get the kids engaged in what composting is. You know, it's not putting material in the landfill that has to be where it can be reused, whether it's brought to community compost sites, brought to our site, or even composted in their backyard. They're trying to teach the kids to be, you know, more eco-friendly and understanding that, you know, what's not just throw it in the trash. That's kind of where I'm seeing a lot of movement going in the schools. And as far as that, they also have a lot of the schools are putting in their own gardens where they're growing vegetables for themselves, for the cafeteria, to be sold at a farm stand to raise money for the school. So it's kind of a really neat trend to see that at this younger age, kids are being engaged in something that's been around for, well, since the beginning. You know, composting has been around forever. I mean, it's a very old practice.
You know, I wish I'd thought to ask you about that, because it's actually something I have no idea about. I mean, part of me feels like it was probably invented in, you know, 1968 during flower power. And, you know, I mean, it just seems like something that would spring from that particular generation. But you're talking about it going back centuries.
Oh, yeah. Actually, and the one largest publication that I use is getting started, and it's still, like, perfect today. It's an on-farm composting handbook, and it was written in 1988. And if you go through and you read that book, the practices that we currently use at our site, it was written then. You know, in 1988 doesn't seem like it was that long ago, but I guess if you add up the years, it's...
Well, compared to a lot of practices that have changed so drastically in the last few decades.
Mm-hmm.
But composting is, you're saying, is a much older practice than that.
Yes, definitely.
Well, actually, composting has been around long before that.
Yeah.
I mean,
long before we were.
Right. So human-centered composting has been around for centuries and centuries. But when you walk around in a prairie or a woodland or a wetland or to a certain extent even on your lawn, everything that dies eventually goes back down into the earth.
True.
But it's just not one concentrated area where it's happening. I mean, when you walk around in a woodland and you pick up a leaf, and it's called a leaf skeleton, and really what's left are the veins and the stem of the leaf, but all of that other cellulose has decomposed. It's composted off, really. And there are so many things. James and I were talking about how soil is a living entity. You know, there are so many things that live in the soil or on top of the soil that are our decomposers. And just like James was talking about the microbes, your unpaid workforce there, making them happy. But, you know, that's what's happening all around us. But you get to see it in action, and it's, you know, sped up when you do home composting or you have a business entity like Blue Ribbon Organics. It's fantastic. It's really exciting.
Right.
So when I put compost on my soil, what does that do for my soil?
Pretty much it just rejuvenates it. So it just it adds the nutrients that it's lacking. Mm-hmm. If it's a clay soil, it helps break down that clay for the root structure to get into the soil and establish itself. For sandy soils, it adds structure to it. So mm-hmm. it kind of does both. It's a soil amendment just to rejuvenate. It's like a shelf life for around 2 years mm-hmm. for nutrient value. You know, compost will continue to break. Why compost is so important, it also holds a lot of moisture. Mm. So it cuts down your watering time. It keeps the plants happy, essentially. So as that compost is put in, it slowly keeps breaking down. And then those nutrients are released into the root structure of the plants, of what you're putting them around.
Mm. And the rest is history.
And the rest is history.
James, if people are interested in getting even more information about Blue Ribbon Organics, do you have a website to which they can turn?
It's www.blueribbonorganics.com.
That doesn't sound too complicated. No. And I'm sure many of our listeners will take advantage of that. Great. James, it's been great to meet you and great to learn about the wonderful world of composting from you. You obviously know it thoroughly and care about it deeply, and it's really fun to make your acquaintance today, and the best wishes to you and everyone who works with you at Blue Ribbon Organics.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
James Utrunka, the owner and operator of Blue Ribbon Organics in Caledonia. Nan Calvert, I think you have some events you want to tell us about in our closing minutes.
I certainly do. So our favorite Sierra Club, Southeast Gateway Group, on April 21st, Tim Van Dielen will be reviewing the story of carnivore recoveries for the Big Four, coyotes, wolves, and black bears and cougars, from the point of view of a professional wildlife conservationist with emphasis on the developments in Wisconsin. You'll be meeting in room 120 of the Biosciences Building right here at the Kenosha campus of Gateway Technical College at 6:30 p.m. If you need any more information or you have a question, just go to the Sierra Club's website and give them a call or send them an email. On April 22nd, Riverbend Nature Center will be having Nature Trivia Night. Doors open at 6:15. The games start at 7 p.m., $10 per person or $100 per table of 10. And you can continue to register for this event through April 20th, but registration is required. Hawthorne Hollow is having its much-beloved Birds and Breakfast event on May 7th from 7 until 11 a.m. Advance tickets are $7, and they are $9 at the door. And it's interesting, go to their website and see how many community sponsors that they have for this event, both in Racine and Kenosha, and one of which is Andrea's. Andrea's is always publicized here, yes. And here's a really fun thing happening in my neck of the woods. Sino Conservancy, we are having a free drone class on May 14th. There are two sessions, one at 9 until noon, and then we're repeating it again at 1 until 4. You may be wondering why we're having a drone class. It's because drones are on the cutting edge of land management practices, forestry, even water quality testing. So they can be used for very, very good things. And we're going to have some drones on hand so people can get some hands-on flying time. You'll get information about rules and regulations, how they're currently being used. So this class is not only for professionals in land management, forestry, parks departments, but it's also for people who are just interested in drones, who want to come out and see what they're like and see what Sino is all about. You do have to register, though. Email to register, it's nan@sinokrlt.org. That's it.
Wonderful. And that last one really does sound especially fascinating.
I think it's going to be fun.
Terrific. Nan Calvert, thank you for organizing these always interesting programs, and we look forward to your visit coming up in May.
It is always my great pleasure. Thank you.
And again, James Utrunka, thank you for joining us today from Blue Ribbon Organics in Caledonia.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, a couple of different things. One, Jean Preston talks about the beautiful children's book that she helped create as a benefit for the Open Wing School here in Kenosha. It's called Banner and the Butterfly, and Banner in the book is a service dog serving a young girl who is on the autism spectrum. It's a beautiful book, a beautiful story, and we'll talk with her about it tomorrow. We'll also help preview for you Frank Allman's upcoming performance Sunday afternoon at Fine Arts at First. Frank Allman, of course, is the concertmaster of the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra. And we'll remind you a little bit about the chamber opera Black September, based on the Munich Olympic hostage tragedy of 1972. That opera, which was first performed in early February, is receiving yet another performance Saturday night as the final event in Carthage's No Hate Week. So all that coming up on tomorrow's morning show. And you find the morning show archived at our website, wgtd.org. Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu.